that will highlight the differences between two models that we look at, namely in 2+1 and 3+1 dimensions, but there will be some overlap because I want to highlight a few of the key points that I don't think Madhavan talked about in great detail. I'll remind again kind of the general philosophy behind what we're doing in both of these cases, which one might call quantum general covariance, or at least some idea related to that. And then I'll show the model again from slightly different perspective. And then I'll look at some hints from this Hussain-Kukash model that Madhavan mentioned, but highlighting some of these hints in a little bit more detail. And then a couple of specifics in that contrast the 2+1 and 3+1 cases. So yeah, as most of us know here, every theory that has diffeomorphism symmetry in Hamiltonian form has constraints that generate this so-called hypersurface deformation algebra that we've all probably seen millions of times. And it really encodes 4D space-time covariance in canonical theory where you're explicitly breaking it. This is this nice result of these gentlemen. So yeah, then the philosophy could be stated as such that a representation of this hypersurface deformation algebra via quantum operators should be required in any canonical theory of quantized geometry, such as GR or even any other geometrical theories, and really defines a notion of what we mean by quantum spacetime covariance. So for example, we would want to have this holding as an operator relation on some space. So, but as we heard about more this morning, state-of-the-art LQG does not sufficiently capture this relation. And we heard about the reasons in detail, but just to remind us of a couple of them, this algebra as normally computed is computed partially on shell, that is, on solutions of diffeomorphism constraint. So you take diffeomorphism invariant distributions and look at kind of generalized matrix elements of this operator relation. And indeed, one finds that the left-hand side vanishes, as you should expect. So this criticism was brought up by Nikolai and some other people. And they give some nice examples where doing this in other well-studied theories kind of gives you wrong spectra of the theory or some other weird behavior. And again, yeah, as we saw this morning, the density weight is responsible for the trivial right-hand side. So if I actually extended this computation to not be on shell, then just the choice of density weight of all these operators kind of conspires to give you a zero on the right-hand side, irrespective of many of the quantization details. On the other hand, the left-hand side, which you might call ultra-locality, is responsible. That is, you know, I have two operators acting here, and these are acting on these spin network states at vertices, and right, the first one acts at some vertex, but it doesn't move this vertex. And so the second one, the second Hamiltonian, just comes and acts there again. And so you get this product of the lapses at the same point, and then you anti-symmetrize. So that thing vanishes for this reason. OK, so there's some things to be sought. I mean, we can try and improve this. So we're going to try and look particularly at this relation in some simpler toy models. So the model that we look at that Madhavan talked about earlier, I like to present it this way because it seems, I don't know, slightly more physical originally due to Smolin. You can see it as a weak coupling limit of Euclidean self-dual gravity in first order formulation. So We've all seen this before. Self-duality in Euclidean signature just means this for the connection. And then you just rescale this connection and take G to 0. And you can do this 3 plus 1 decomposition, and you come out with very familiar looking phase space action with constraints. And really the only difference is you have a Gauss constraint, U1, 3 U1 Gauss constraints as opposed to an SU2 Gauss constraint. But you still have diffeomorphisms, and the Hamiltonian takes the same form, but the curvature is abelian. Okay, so, yeah, and it's no surprise that the subalgebra of the diffeomorphisms and Hamiltonians again generates this hypersurface deformation algebra. So then the goal is to, yeah, quantize this H so that I get this commutator relation off shell. Okay, so I want to highlight some of these lessons that come from the diff constraint that I think are pretty important, and kind of highlight the differences in the two ways that we can achieve this off-shell closure. So in that case, the idea is to construct some diffeomorphism generator that obeys, represents the Lie algebra of spatial vector fields. So the strategy there is to, you know, use what you know classically, geometrically about what this constraint should do, right? You know that it generates Lie derivatives. But I know I can't define the generator directly on kinematical Hilbert space because these finite unitaries corresponding to diffeomorphisms aren't weakly continuous. So this thing, we know it doesn't exist on kinematical Hilbert space, but if you know that it's supposed to generate a Lie derivative, then at finite triangulation, parameterized by this delta, right? Let me see if I can make an operator which gives this action on the kinematical Hilbert space, right? And this looks strikingly similar to definition of Lie derivative. So you can imagine how this could lead to something that we want. So if I want to do this, what is required of regularization and quantization choices, right? As Manavan emphasized, you know, when you have to quantize these local operators here, in LQG, you have to make some choice of surfaces, loops, holonomies, etc. And we have lots of freedom to do that. So, you know, what really is required so that I get this relation? So one thing that I don't think Manavan mentioned much was that the curvature operator that appears in D, you really need it to acquire some non-trivial state dependence and non-perturbative modifications. So by state dependence, I mean not just, right, this is a, yeah, so let's explain this formula here. This is the curvature operator at finite triangulation delta. And the first term is just the usual thing that you would use to approximate curvature holonomy around some loop, divided by loop area, right? And this loop, usually in LQG, is tuned to the underlying spin network state that you're acting on. But what Alok and Madhavan found for diff constraint is that you really need to tune it also to these representation labels that are on the state, right? It's not enough just to have the shapes matching, but you need this extra information. Moreover, you see this extra weird, curious term here. Classically, okay, so this extra factor here is a flux smeared along some size delta surface, so area delta squared. So in terms of the regulating parameter delta, this whole thing is higher order in delta than the first term. So classically, if I take the delta goes to zero limit, the first term gives me the curvature, the local curvature, and the second term just vanishes with respect to it. But in quantum theory, these things, you could say they have comparable Hilbert space norms, right? They can, I mean, things like this can cancel each other in quantum theory, even though they're not comparable classically. And we have this freedom in LQG, and this is something that we use a lot in both of the quantizations. The other thing is that, right, normally this D is the integral of some local density over manifold, and it's regularized as a sum over some triangulation that you choose. But if I'm at finite triangulation and I'm going to neglect higher order in regulating parameter pieces, I can replace this sum over, right? So yeah, the basic idea is here. You have a sum over some index set I of some quantities x multiplied by a small parameter delta. Well, that's the same as the product over 1 plus those things minus 1 plus corrections delta squared. Right, so this is crucial in getting an operator to work like this. Right, if you just had a sum and used this curvature or any other curvature, this operator turns out to be not well defined. And then the other question is, yeah, what space is going to support this delta goes to zero limit? Right here I have an explicit 1 over delta times regular operator. It's not going to be well defined on kinematical Hilbert space, so I need some other space which gives me a non-singular value when I take delta to zero. So it turns out to be not h-kin, of course, but a well-chosen set of distributions over h-kin. It's the so-called Lewandowski-Morrell habitat. So, and then this thing acts just like a Lie derivative, just the way it was built to act, right? It acts on one of these states, and it preserves this space of states, and just this f here is a smooth function similar to these habitat states that Madhavan introduced, and you just Lie derive this thing. Okay. So now we want to apply some of these things, in particular this sum to product formula and the availability of these non-perturbative corrections. Right? This is really like a huge amount of freedom that we have in LQG. And you know, we can exploit it to sort of get what we want. Okay, so I'll talk about the 3 plus, just remind you about this 3 plus 1 real quick, and then I'll turn to the 2 plus 1 and highlight some of the differences. So classically, we choose this density weight so that in the Hamiltonian constraint, you have a factor q to the minus third sitting there, and then the Laplace function is appropriately densitized so that this object is a density weight 0 vector field. And then you can just compute its action on connection, and you get this kind of Lie derivative structure plus some gauge transformation, which we'll throw away because we work on gauge invariant states. So there, right, we know how triad operator acts in quantum theory. You kind of naturally get this, you know, the spin network vertex kind of naturally splits into a sum of vectors along those edge tangents. All right, so yeah, so if this splits like this, then I can translate this into an action, right, this geometrical interpretation here into an action on charge networks that has this form. Basically, I have some multiplicative guys here that come from N and the Q, and then I have a sum over edges at a particular vertex, and then I have some deformed charge network minus the original charge network. And those deformations look like this that we saw this morning. They kind of, each one goes along a particular edge up to some higher order in delta corrections. Right, so these are kind of very singular bunchings. So yeah, it wasn't mentioned, but getting something like this to, getting the Hamiltonian to actually give you something like this, you know, if I just want to make operator replacements, you know, make finite triangulation operator replacements in the Hamiltonian, you really are using this freedom that you have for non-perturbative corrections, right? It's not stated explicitly, but you know you can do it. And so I know I can get this, but it might take a very complicated choice of curvature to get it. Okay. Yeah, and then the key point here was that this non-trivial vertex is actually moved, right? These dotted lines here, they're actually still part of the state. They have non-trivial U1 charges, but this V here, if you can see, right, all the edges here, they're no longer charged in one of the copies of U1, and that makes this thing volume degenerate. So in a sense, right, the non-zero volume vertex has moved over here. So this is kind of remarkable, because now this the second H is going to act at this point, and I lose this ultra-low catalytic problem. In 2 plus 1, we do it a little bit differently. We just have one of these electric shifts per vertex, right? So instead of a sum of deformations along edges, I'm just going to have a single one, which is right here. Sorry, this is a little small. And we spent some more time trying to get, you know, an explicit replacement of the local Hamiltonian in terms of these finite triangulation operators that really gives this kind of structure. So we have like an explicit, you know, sum to product form over the different deformations that you would get per edge. So, but the problem here, right, this is, you know, it's kind of the simplest thing you can do, but the problem is that, you know, this new vertex that I created here is only charged in a single copy of this U1, and so this is a degenerate vertex, right? So we're probably going to see this ultra-locality problem again here. So, but then the solution is to really exploit this availability of the non-perturbative corrections to ensure that this vertex moves under the action of a second Hamiltonian. All right, we see this just schematically, right? If this HI, I'm just writing HI here for the Hamiltonian with a fixed value of the curvature internal index. This thing is, right, this is what this electric shift, the electric shift is proportional to this triad. And a second Hamiltonian should move that vector, right? So you get something like this, and it's proportional to this derivative of n. So we can work this in using the availability of these non-perturbative corrections. Yeah. Okay. So, but the moral is, yeah, we should pay more attention to these classical Hamiltonian vector fields, because that's what really gave us this information. So there's really, I think there's some more to understand about classical flow of these things. And then just briefly, yeah. On the right-hand side, we use two different ideas. Basically, this very nice identity that Madhavan mentioned to give it the structure of a commutator. But in 2 plus 1, you can also just do a reordering so that, you know, I'm again, you know, writing this thing as some flipped diffeos. Okay, so that's all. We have off-shell closure in a precise sense. So it seemed there was maybe some confusion. Right, really what we have is we have matrix elements, right? That is, this is the first thing that you can get, right? I have some finite triangulation commutator, and I take that limit on some particular space of states, these habitat states, and it matches with the same limit of this right-hand side operator, right? And there's more than one way to do it. Seems SU2 looks promising. Alok has some nice results, even some off-shell closure for low valence vertices already, I think. And then notice that the just one speculation, something that I'd like to think about, is that this in the E representation, right, all these constraints in this U1 cube model are linear in momenta. So they're really vector fields on configuration space, so you might be able to study it from a different point of view. Thanks.
A quick question.
If I understand correctly, yeah, I have a question about ultra-locality problem. If I understand correctly, so you find a solution to that problem by moving the vertex?
Yes.
How about another possibility? If you don't move vertices, but consider really this Euclidean part of the Hamiltonian as a holonomy around the loop and then the edge and back. If you consider this elementary Hamiltonian, your total Hamiltonian is the sum of such vertex contributions. When you do the commutator, it should be some non-trivial commutator. It should not vanish.
Yeah, maybe I'm not understanding exactly why. Yeah, perhaps we can talk about it. Oh.
Yeah.
That way the new vertex doesn't have a non-degenerate eigenvalue. The inverse volume vanishes, and so the second constraint doesn't see that new vertex or that new definition.
Yeah, the problem is to evaluate.
I mean, on trivalent, you need at least a four-valent gauge invariant vertex for the inverse determinant of the metric to be non-zero. So if the way you do it produces such a vertex, then one can go forward and then investigate what happens. The usual ways of doing it don't produce such a vertex. Because you're just adding edges to other edges. So you get like and we will talk about canonical effective equations for quantum field theory.
Hi, so I'm Shuddha Chattopadhyay. I'm a grad student at Penn State. And today I'm going to tell you about canonical effective equations for QFT. All of this work was done with my advisor, Martin Boyewald, and partially with Elliot Nelson. OK, so let me go straight to the most relevant question: why use effective equations? Why should we even study them? And we believe that there are certain advantages in certain scenarios if we use these equations. So first of all, using these methods, correlation functions are calculated with a completely generalized state, which does not have to be Gaussian or even pure. And such states are relevant in the context of cosmology. Additionally, we can avoid several technical difficulties like what is the exact structure of inner products in the Hilbert space or which self-adjoint extension to use. And thus, there's a very natural way of recovering semi-classical behavior from a system using these. As I hope to illustrate through a quantum mechanics example, there's a systematic way to realize higher derivative corrections in the equations using these methods. And finally, when I go to the full 3+1 theory, I hope to recover some very standard results using QFT, but also add some perspectives on certain features like renormalization. And since our final goal is to quantize a field theory with a dynamical background, these insights might come in handy then, but that's speculation. And finally, I hope to talk very briefly about how we can apply this to certain models of LQG. OK, so quantum mechanics first. And we define these moment variables. The while here stands for total symmetric ordering. The state about which we take the expectation value is completely arbitrary at this point, which we fix later on. And we have just chosen one canonical pair. For simplicity, there can be as many as we want. And given a Hamiltonian operator, we define the effective Hamiltonian like so. And now we have an infinite dimensional space because there are infinite number of these moment terms. And a point in it is completely specified by the expectation value of q, p, and these moments. Next, we define a Poisson bracket through the commutator. And it's a good definition because it follows Leibniz rule, linearity, anti-symmetry. And using such a definition, I can find out the Poisson bracket between the variables of my theory. So then I can get the equations of motion for the expectation value of q, p, and the moments. And so what we have achieved so far is instead of solving the usual Schrodinger's partial differential equation in quantum mechanics, I'm attempting to solve an infinite set of infinitely coupled ordinary differential equations. Infinite because there are infinite number of these moments, coupled because they appear in these equations for q and p. So a priori, it doesn't seem simple at all, but hopefully I'll convince you in certain scenarios they can simplify. I should mention here that the solutions to these are subject to certain uncertain relations, which I'm not going to be able to discuss today. Let's look at an example, a quantum anharmonic oscillator. And so I have the harmonic oscillator Hamiltonian plus some generic anharmonicity. This is one of the strengths of the system. I don't need to specify the anharmonicity. at this point, and I can get the effective Hamiltonian using my prescription to be this, and where I just relabel the moments so that the calculations become slightly easier now. And then these are the equations of motion for expectation value of Q, P, and the moments. As promised, there is the back reaction of the moments appearing here. So the strategy is to solve for the moments, plug those values in these equations for expectation values of Q and P, and solve for them. But the difficulty is there's an infinite number of terms in the equations of motion for the moments in the square root of h bar. So we need to make certain approximations, the first of which is we have to assume that the moments can be solved perturbatively in a series in square root of h bar. But instead, we just expand them in a dimensionless parameter, where L is some angular momentum scale provided by the perturbing potential. We also need to make an adiabatic approximation, where we assume that the moments vary slowly with time, so that such that like the second order derivative of the moments is smaller than the first order derivative, and so on. But we impose no restrictions on the expectation values of Q and P. So we scale the time derivatives with respect to some fictitious parameter lambda, and we set lambda equals 1 at the end. So we make two expansions, infinite expansions of these moments, one in square root of h bar, the other in lambda. And a priori, this second expansion might not be well defined because it's in some fictitious parameter. But after doing the calculations, we found out that we could have as easily expanded them in a derivative expansion, and that would be more mathematically rigorous, and they give you the same result. So at any order in square root of h bar, the adiabatic approximation to the leading order is given by this, and this is what it is for higher orders. So this turns out to be the zeroth order h bar, zeroth order adiabatic solutions for the moments. It appears with some constants in front. We choose the constant to be this, such that the state about which we take these expectation values are the ground state of the harmonic oscillator. We did not have done that. We do so for concreteness, but up to here, the states were completely general. We could have kept it general for the rest of the talk as well. And these are the first order adiabatic solutions. These are first order h bar. I won't bore you with these, but let me show you the equation of motion for Q. So this is like the classical part. These are the quantum corrections. And the relevant moments are noted down here. It's slightly easier to understand if I rewrite that equation like this. So this is the classical part. These are the quantum corrections. And the important thing is I can separate the quantum correction as single derivatives of Q, double derivatives, third derivative, and fourth order derivatives. The pre-functions, I have just written them down here, but they're not important for our purposes. And the takeaway message from this part of the talk is that there's a very systematic way of getting these higher derivative corrections. I went up to the fourth adiabatic order. I get up to the fourth order derivatives of Q. And that's really the advantage of using this adiabatic approximation over here. OK, so what I've shown you some solutions. How do you know they're even correct, or what you are doing here makes any sense? One way would be to like choose some enharmonicity, like a quartic enharmonicity. And we know how to solve that using usual quantum mechanics, match up those results with these. And we have done that. And I could have shown you that, but that's boring. So let me instead talk about this Coleman-Weinberg potential, where I hope to convince you that what we did makes some sense. So the Coleman-Weinberg potential for some Lagrangian like this, where there's a non-zero VV, turns out to be this. And this is exactly the expression for this is the one loop correction to the effective potential. And this is for the 3 plus 1 theory, there would be just a d4k over here. Everything else is just the same. But in one, like in quantum mechanics, this is obviously integrable. And I can do this integration and get the one loop correction to be this for the Coleman-Weinberg potential. And then if I recall my effective Hamiltonian for the anharmonic oscillator, I plug in for the moments, go up to whichever order in h bar I want to go up to, go up to whichever order in adiabatic corrections I want to go up to, and get the, again, effective potential. And in that case, the one loop correction turns out to be this. And this is the two loop correction. The thing is, I can do this analysis not for an anharmonic oscillator, but for some generic potential over here. And had I done that, I would get the one loop correction to be this, and the two loop correction to be this to the Coleman-Weinberg potential. And now if I go back and match this up with the results from usual QFT, the one loop correction matches up. So why did I show you the two-loop correction is just to say that this adiabatic approximation helps over here. We just need to keep the zeroth-order adiabatic terms. And that's why going up to higher loop orders is rather simple in this scheme.
This is not QFT. This is quantum mechanics.
This is quantum mechanics at this point, yes.
Because you said higher order from QFTs.
Oh, no. Sorry. I mean, like using standard like techniques. That's what I meant by QFT. Yeah, so just to be sure that I will talk a little bit about QFT. I didn't like con my way by saying that this is QFT. So some features. The setup is like we are going to use in informalism because we had cosmology as the motivation. I'm sticking to phi-fourth Hamiltonian, but we even considered phi-cubed interaction term. This is how we define the moments, but now they have space-time levels. But in informalism, they're equal time correlations, so there are different spatial labels, but only one time label. And this is how derivatives act. So again, I get my effective Hamiltonian to be this. All the terms in red are due to the phi-fourth perturbation. All the terms in black are the free field terms, free field with phi-squared potential. And again, the Poisson algebra is just like before, except there's a delta function because this is field theory. The equation of motions will be derived just like before, and that's why I went through the quantum mechanics example. Okay, so this is the equation of motion for phi and pi. These are the perturbation terms. Terms in black are the free field theory terms. These are second order moments, so this is like phi with pi, and pi with pi. And again, black is free field, red is perturbation. So the generic scheme for higher order moments is this. Any moment appearing on the right-hand side here, the time derivative of it either appears on the equation before it or appears on the equation after it. So if we forget about the perturbation terms to begin with, this is a complete set of equations. I have as many unknowns as equations. I can solve them. So the black terms, the free field theory terms, I should be able to solve for any order moments by themselves. Of course, when I add perturbations, I can't do that. I have more unknowns than knowns than equations. So I have to do something else. And I do something very similar like before, where I expand the moments in now the coupling constant, which is like expanding them in h bar. And then I start solving with the free field solution. So I ignore the red terms. I solve the free field solutions. So those are solutions with g subscript 0. And then I plug those in the red terms to get equations for the g subscript 1, solve for them, do this iteratively, get up to whichever order in lambda I want to go up to. And then if you remember the definition for the moments, this is getting the correlation functions from the moments. Endpoint functions are not very difficult. OK, but I'm not going to talk about solutions either, because that'll take a whole talk by itself. But let me just show you some features. So let me talk a little bit about renormalization. This one is slightly hand-waving arguments to say that we know that in 3 plus 1 dimensions, phi-fourth is the maximum theory that we can renormalize. Anything higher than phi-fourth, we can't renormalize. And there is a very, we can easily show that this moment expansion is actually valid only up to phi-fourth, or phi-cubed to phi-squared. But anything above phi-fourth, this moment expansion breaks down. But this is slightly hand-waving to argument. But there's a more mathematical argument, for example, for cancellation of the tadpole term. So let's look at the equation motion for expectation value of phi. So this is a free field one. And this is just Klein-Gordon equation, except this is not for the operator phi, but for the expectation value. So this is what I mean when I say that we have a more general state space, because now phi does not have to be 0 even for free field theory, which we know is the case for QFT, if you use the Minkowski vacuum, that is. But when I turn on the perturbation, these are the additional terms. So of course, QFT should be a subspace of these solutions. Of course, I should get phi equal to 0 to be a subspace of the solution. So it should be a solution of this as well. And in order to do that, I need this term in blue to go to 0. Now, for phi-fourth theory, it is 0. For phi-fourth theory, phi, phi, phi is 0 because of the symmetry of the Hamiltonian. So phi equal to 0 is a solution of this equation. But for phi-cubed theory, again, this is the free field theory term. These are the perturbations. And now I need this blue term to go to 0. And it doesn't, because if I had time, I would show you that g02 with the same arguments actually blows up. It's a divergent term. So how can I get phi equal to 0 to be to be a solution of this equation? Because I need to cancel the tadpole term. The only way is to add a term to the effective Hamiltonian, or equivalent to the Lagrangian, which is proportional to phi, and whose coefficient cancels out this blue term. So basically adding a counter term to the Lagrangian, which is proportional to phi. And if you remember, this is exactly how the tadpole term has to be canceled in phi-cubed theory using usual QFT. If you don't add that term proportional to phi, you cannot cancel out this divergent term over here, and you cannot cancel the tadpole term.
So the second term is not the second term in 3.9 is not divergent, the second red term?
This term? But G03 with any arguments is 0 for phi-fourth theory using standard QFT.
Why? The second red term.
Oh, here? Yes, but here I want phi equal to 0 to be a solution. So I mean, that term, anything proportional to 0 would go to 0.
But I mean, this should be also a divergent term.
Yes, this is a divergent term, but I mean, this goes to zero more strongly. Maybe I should, that's not a good answer. I should come back to you. Okay, so how much time do I have?
2 minutes.
Okay, so since I have 2 minutes, let me not show you one more calculation, which I just put in here. So basically, the idea is if I wanted to solve for the propagator using this mechanism, I get some general solutions, and then specifying some initial values for this, I get a particular solution. So if I specify some initial value, I can get back the QFT propagator, and we have calculated it up to one loop order to match with QFT. Of course, again, this is not the only solution. This is just a particular solution of these equations, effective equations that we have. We do get QFT solution to be a part of that solution. But let me not talk too much about that. So let me conclude. So I end with the question I started with, why effective equations? Hopefully I've convinced you, or at least made you curious, that they can be more applicable or easier to handle in certain scenarios. And where are they being used, or where are we using them? So we had some toy model of quantum cosmology where we used this anharmonic oscillator. But more importantly, we are currently working to add this quantum correction, this moment corrections to the scalar and diffeomorphism constraints of spherical LQG, and see what effects, if any, they have on the hypersurface deformation algebra. And then why is it important to add this is because these actually change the phase space of the constraint algebra. So I mean, unless we add this, we don't get a whole picture of what would happen if we add both perturbative and non-perturbative corrections. And how does changes that hypersurface deformation algebra, if at all. But this is like current work. Thank you.
This is very interesting kind of approximation methods. But I sort of somewhat strongly disagree with your first transparency, and that this was supposed to be a substitute, or this does not use Hilbert spaces, and does not have to worry about self-adjoint operators, which extension you choose, etc. So let me just sort of say a couple of sentences about this, which is that supposing, in fact, I have a quantum mechanical system in which I have inequivalent self-adjoint extensions, then I solve quantum mechanically, and I find dynamics is different.
Right.
And you'll find that dynamics is You don't see this difference. So obviously your answer is wrong. So, and the reason why it is wrong is that some of the approximations you have made break down.
Yes.
So it's sort of misleading, I think, to say that one does not have to worry about non-unique self-adjoint extensions.
Sorry, to answer that question, I completely agree with you. In fact, I didn't mean that. Okay, so what I meant is, in certain scenarios, this can still extract the semi-classical behavior, and to give an example, I think, would be in this toy quantum cosmology model that we're using. The point was, if we don't get a singularity at a point using these methods, then perhaps there is no singularity there. But if there is a singularity using these methods, I can be wrong, because there can be some boundary effects coming from the full quantum theory, which I'm wrong about. So I mean, yeah, in generically, it's not like using this, I can always extract some classical behavior.
Right. So it's, it's somewhat, I mean, it's an approximation method.
Yes,
it's not
yes.
a substitute for the full theory.
No.
You need Hilbert space for those relations that you did not write down.
Yes, that
you cannot specify moments arbitrarily.
Yes.
You need Hilbert space to write down the Poisson brackets between the moments.
Right.
Because the moment, the Poisson bracket is just the imaginary part of the inner product in the Hilbert space. So it's just sort of, I think it's much better. I mean, if you present it as saying that here is a approximation method which might be useful in many cases, I mean,
But yeah, you're right, like this adiabatic approximation and so on, they break down in many regimes and they're not applicable always at all.
Thank
I
you.
Briefly mentioned that when I said like the...
Thank you. I just wanted to clarify. Yeah. Thank you.
Yeah, so maybe I can ask a question because you had all these many quantum...
Yes, so sorry.
...equations with endpoint functions where some seem to be kind of divergent.
Yes.
So you have to regularize.
Where is it? Okay, maybe here. So it turns out like when we regularize, for the propagator, like which is basically the G02, we can regularize it such that up to one loop it matches with QFT. I mean, I wasn't stressing that point here because I was more concerned about to show how like the expectation value of phi can go to zero. But I mean, you're absolutely right. There is like a regularization procedure I should do first and like make this like not blow up. And then, so I mean, I cannot do this in complete generality. Like I go for G02 with up to some order, and then I plug that in here and then try to seek for solutions where phi goes to zero. But that was not the point here. But yeah, if I discuss the propagator in more detail, I would mention that.
Okay, so let's move on.
Thank you.
From Erlangen, we talk about the Bowen-Oppenheimer approximation for non-commuting slow wave waves.
Okay, thank you very much, and thank you to the organizers for giving me the opportunity to present this work. So it's work with Thomas Thiemann.
Speak up.
Okay. So it's work with Thomas Thiemann, and it's about to appear hopefully soon. And so the outline of the talk is the following. I will give you the conceptual setup for the Born-Oppenheimer approximation and how it should be generalized. And in the second part, I will discuss the generalization in terms of coherent states. And then I will apply this to theories defined on phase spaces with a cotangent bundle of U1 or SU2, and possible applications to LQG, LQC, or Wheeler-DeWitt theory. And I will conclude with some remarks and an outlook. So the conceptual setup is the following. The Born-Oppenheimer decomposition has somehow a long tradition in quantum gravity. This is, for example, discussed in this book by Klaus Kiefer. And in the following, I will assume that we have a splitting of a gravity matter system into slow and fast variables. And in terms of the Hilbert spaces, it should be given like a tensor product of the slow variables and the fast. And the approximation schemes in this setting are usually governed by adiabatic scales, which are, they could be something like the mesh ratios between the matter fields and the Planck mass, but you could also divide it or separate off some parts of the gravitational field degrees of freedom. And its direct application to loop quantum gravity is in some sort prevented by the non-commutativity of the fluxes. And at least if one wants to work in a representation which allows your parametrization by classical metrics in a fast sector. And this was discussed in this paper. But it's also important to note that the Born-Oppenheimer decomposition is not a classical approximation per se, and this discussed in this book, for example. But we will combine it with coherent states to get a handle on the semi-classical limit and the adiabatic limit simultaneously. So, and in this sense, we can somehow surpass some of the difficulties posed by the non-commutativity of the fluxes. And on some remarks are in order here. So it's interesting that if you want to pass from a quantum gravity theory to quantum field theory on curved spacetimes, and this is some sort of measurement problem in disguise, because you have to figure out the classical background on which you want to work. And if you consider the measurement problem, then it was just this year pointed out by Lanzmann and Roivers that could be advantages to consider the adiabatic and the semi-classical limit at the same time. So perhaps from the methods there, one could get some input how to treat this. And furthermore, the application of this framework seems to be also suited for deparametrized models, but you can also treat completely covariant models. And from a mathematical point of view, somehow you have intriguing connections with complex geometry, microlocal analysis, and the pseudo-differential calculus. So, and how does the Born-Oppenheimer decomposition look like? So that it's somehow generalized form. You consider a quantum mechanical system which is given by a Hilbert, some Hamiltonian acting on a Hilbert space, and you have an algebra of, say, elementary operators. And you assume a splitting, again as before, of the Hilbert space in this algebra into slow and fast degrees of freedom. And then, furthermore, the Hamiltonian should decompose into one part which acts on the slow system and one part which describes the coupling of the slow system and the fast system. And then, if you find that a certain subset of your elementary operators is a commutative subalgebra, then you can consider the restrictions of your coupling between the slow and the fast system on the joint spectral subspaces of this part of your algebra. And these will be the restrictions. And then you can use the eigenvalue problem of these restrictions to the spectral subspaces to parametrize the full eigenvalue problem of your Hamiltonian. And this equation looks somehow like this. So lambda would be the eigenvalue you're asking for. This is somehow the spectral function for these restrictions. The psi are the solutions. This n is the spectral index of this operator. And you have here some sort of generalized Barry-Simon connection. So, and up to this point, the Born-Oppenheimer equation is exact. And then you can apply approximation schemes. And the original Born-Oppenheimer approximation is just you set the Barry-Simon connection to zero. And another one, which is commonly applied, is that you use the adiabatic or no mixing approximation, namely that every connection preserves the eigenspace decomposition of your coupling Hamiltonian. And then you can also consider effective Hamiltonians and for the slow variables. And they are given by the form that you restrict the dynamics of your whole system to the spectral subspaces or these coupling Hamiltonians. You know, and this looks like this, where the N and MFs are the eigenstates, in a sense, which belong to this part of the Hamiltonian. And if you do this in the adiabatic approximation, then you come to this setting of quantum geometric forces on the spectrum of the Qs. And an additional complication here arises due to spectral instabilities. For example, you can have eigenvalue crossings or bifurcations in your spectrum. And the quality of the approximations in general is controlled by spectral gap conditions. So, and in the coherent state form, which we propose, this looks a bit different, namely, or essentially similar in the beginning. You have again a triple, which defines your quantum mechanical system, and but the algebra of elementary operators is somehow changed, and these A's and A stars, they should indicate that you work somehow with creation and annihilation operators. And the decomposition this time looks like this, but you do not require that there is that this coupling of slow and fast degrees of freedom only happens to commutative commutative subalgebra of your algebra of elementary operators. So this is the main thing you change, and this is somehow what happens if you do this in loop quantum gravity. For example, in the Brown-Kukach-Dust models, there it looks more like this form. And now you take a complete set of coherent states in the slow sector, namely, they should be eigenstates for the annihilation operators. You have a resolution of unity, and the completeness is meant in the following sense. You take the diagonal expectation values of any operator in the slow sector, and this is only vanishing if the operator itself is vanishing. So this typically, if you have a holomorphic family of coherent states, then you can just deduce this from holomorphicity of the states. And if you have this, then you see that you can now get a diagonal form for almost any operator in your slow Hilbert space. So this is, in this sense, this coherent state resolution of unity is much different from what you know from the spectral theorem. And what you then do is you decompose this object which occurs in this diagonal form. This is usually called the upper symbol of your operator. You can do a spectral decomposition of this operator on the fiber spaces, on the fast spaces which are now labeled by your manifold which indexes the coherent states. And as an input for the complete eigenvalue problem of your original Hamiltonian. And then the equation looks somehow similar to the original Born-Oppenheimer equation. The main difference is this term here. So this is some sort of differential integral operator, but it's somehow supported on the diagonal. So it's almost like a delta function. And the resolution of unity then additionally gives rise to some sort of fiber bundle structure of your Hilbert space. So you only consider holomorphic sections of a bundle over your space, which indexes the coherent state families. And this typically leads to an additional flatness constraint on the solution. Because you're only working with holomorphic sections, you somehow need some sort of covariant holomorphicity condition. And this is also formulated in terms of sort of connection, which arises in the same sense as in the original Born-Oppenheimer approach. So there's now also some remarks on this part. So the upper symbol is in general not unique, but you can determine it from the lower symbol by duality. And this is typically non-trivial. And it exists for a strongly dense set of operators. So this was proven by Simon and further elaborated by Klauder and Skagerstam. And the solutions to the eigenvalue equation of H can now be considered as holomorphic horizontal sections of this bundle I mentioned. And on this complexified slow phase space, if you choose coherent states which are labeled by phase space points. And the main difference in the approach, again, arises through this integral operator, which is a composition of the kernel of your coherent states and a sort of bundle transition operator, which relates the spectral subspaces over your phase space, which correspond to this coupling operator. And similar to the traditional approach, we have the generalized Berry-Simon connection. And completeness, for example, of this coherent states can be conveniently achieved in the complexifier framework because of holomorphicity, but it's not necessary. You can also do it in some other ways. I mean, for example, in the setting of Perelomov states, it follows from highest weight representation theory that you can also get there some complete sets of coherent states. And now you can also try to apply approximation schemes, and you can devise something similar to the original Born-Oppenheimer equation, but you have to do it in a semi-classical limit where this integral operator is mainly supported on the diagonal. And again, you can ask for effective Hamiltonians, but this is always easiest formulated in the semi-classical limit, but it requires a detailed asymptotic expansion of this object, which is possible if you work with heat kernel coherent states, because then you have a lot of control on this object. So now to the more concrete examples. So if you work with a cotangent bundle of U1 as your phase space, then the slow Hilbert space can be represented in this way. And the set of elementary operators, they have two. So you have essentially the phase operator and its associated momentum. And if you do the heat kernel method to construct coherent states, then you define this type of annihilation and creation operators. And essentially, just for completeness, the formulas for the resolution of unity in the coherent states and annihilation operators look like this. And then the main ingredient is the upper symbol of your coupling operator. And this can be determined from the matrix elements on this type of Fock space for the theory, or from the lower symbol. And the possible inversion formula looks like this. So it's not so important to remember all the details of this formula, but there is a definite expression to compute it. And it mainly involves Fourier analysis on U1. So in the SU2 case, you can do it similar. So you start from the L2 space on SU2 with respect to the Hahn measure. And your elementary operators are again constructed from the holonomies and the flux operators. So this is in this setting which was given in the Thiemann and Winkler work, where you have these flux operators which are essentially associated to certain edges. And then you construct again these heat kernel complexified coherent states with these annihilation and creation operators. And in this setting, you can again determine the upper symbol from the lower symbol or from some sort of nonlinear Fock space where you decompose your L2 space into some sort of left and right-handed spin subspaces. And in analogy with the U1 case, you can again get an inversion formula. And what's interesting to note here is that this inversion formula looks again quite complicated, but the main non-trivial input you need is the upper symbol of the ground state projection, which is not so easy to obtain. So and let me come to applications in quantum gravity. There, as a first attempt, we just, as a toy model, we applied it to the Wiedler-De-Witt theory because it makes computations easier and you can just work with the canonical coherent states, which you are familiar from in the framework of the harmonic oscillator. And if you consider just Friedmann, Lemaître, Robertson, Walker cosmology coupled to a scalar field, and you do a certain type of dust reduction with a symmetrized dust action, then you obtain this type of reduced action, and this leads you to the following coherent state, Born-Oppenheimer equation, which is somewhat the same as the Born-Oppenheimer equation you could obtain in this case as well, because you don't have the commutativity problem here. But you have this sort of smeared potential, which comes from the eigenvalue decomposition of the coupling operator between, essentially of the scalar field where you have the scale factor there. So, and yeah, further applications to LQG and LQC are under consideration. So we are still working out this for canonical LQG. And there's also earlier work, which is somehow along similar lines, which was by Hanno Salmann and Thomas Thiemann. But they made use of the lower symbol, and you cannot use this in this coherent state Born-Oppenheimer equation, but probably you can use it to determine the upper symbol and then make use of this work. An extension to somehow, if you just use the states on one copy of SU2, you can easily extend it to finite graphs, but to infinite graphs it could also be possible by this use of the infinite tensor product construction. But it's not clear if this somehow leads to a good behavior in the semi-classical limit when it comes to approximations. And in the U1 case, we want to try to apply to the LQC setting or to linearized gravity or Maxwell theory in this U1 to the cube setting. And what's also be interesting to do this in a gauge invariant sector. So far this was for gauge variant states, but in a sense it's not strictly necessary because the coherent states are mainly a technical tool here. You do not they are not really physical input, but they just allow you to introduce some sort of handle on the semi-classical limit. But when it comes to the approximation schemes, then it could be advantageous to use the gauge invariant case. And furthermore, since the volume operator in most of this, at least in LQG, if the vacuum and the matter coupling Hamiltonians, they always find the volume operator, therefore it should be in some sense crucial to discuss its relation to the coherent state framework. So now some final remarks and outlook. So as I said, the hardest part somehow of this analysis is to attempt the detailed asymptotic analysis of this integral operator and the upper symbol. And this is somehow much more involved than in the original Born-Oppenheimer equation. But the proposed methods apply to general Hamiltonian systems, where you can do this fast-slow decomposition. And especially in LQG, you can apply it to totally constrained system as well as deparametrized models. And what's also interesting to see is that the nonlinear Fock space structure, which we used here, this is somewhat different from the one which was so far discussed in the literature, for example, by Brian Hall, which also makes use of this coherent state transformations. But nevertheless, you can also generalize these constructions to Lie groups of arbitrary compact type. And similarly, the inversion formulas, which are presented, these are also generalizable to the to general Lie groups, but you always have to find this ground state projection upper symbol, and this is quite non-trivial. So, and now the last slide. So this framework, we have also applied this framework to the canonical coherent states on, and to atomic coherent states on S2, where you can also use it. And there the inversion formulas are well known from the theory of quantum optics. It's known under the name of P representation. And furthermore, it would be interesting to find complexifiers or complete systems on the whole Hilbert spaces, so for LQG or LQC. And this is somewhat non-trivial, but there have been attempts. And this would allow to consider untruncated dynamics. And what's somewhat along other lines is that you find these Dirac operators in the definition of the annihilation and creation operators, and so far unclear why exactly these operators should appear there. It would be interesting to find out. And in the U1 case, you can also deduce that the annihilation and creation operators give rise to a certain quantum group, namely a quantum Heisenberg algebra. And perhaps one can also find something similar in the SU2 case. And further, one other link which would be interesting to discuss further is how these coherent states methods can be used in the twisted geometries framework. But the coherent states we employ here, they are somewhat different from those they employ. Okay, thank you very much.
So, a fast question. Is there a relation between those states and the one introduced by Oridi?
By whom? Actually, I'm not sure in this case. But here, the important thing is that you have this completeness property, otherwise the approach will not work.
They have a completeness property.
But not completeness in the sense of resolution of unity, but you need this, that some of the diagonal expectation values determine your operator completely. Okay.
Olmedo talking about totally constrained model with SLR.
Okay, I want to first of all, acknowledge the organizers of the conference for letting me give this talk here. What I'm going to talk about is a quantization prescription for an SL2R model within a new approach called the uniform discretization. This work has been done in collaboration with Rodolfo Gambini. Okay, the idea is that we would like to test several aspects of the uniform discretization approach in a model that is as simple as possible while it has some complications, like for example one can find in more general theories like general relativity. The advantage of this model is that it has a finite number of degrees of freedom. It possesses a Hamiltonian which is totally constrained in the sense that it is a linear combination of first class constraints. The constraint algebra mimics the one of general relativity somehow, and the gauge group is a little bit pathological one in the sense that you do not have an invariant measure and therefore you cannot apply standard technique like the group averaging. for the quantization. And what the uniform discretization approach? The thing is that this is a new point of view for quantizing this kind of model, in the sense that you are dealing with you start with a discrete theory, which is free of constraints. You quantize it, and you check whether you are able to recover the continuous theory from the discrete one. Therefore, since the quantization, since the theory is free of constraints, we can apply a standard quantization techniques, and then see whether we recover at the end of the day the continuous theory out of the quantum description. Okay. The classical system consists of two pairs of canonically conjugate variables, the U's, P's, and the V pi's, and the system is described by three constraints, two which are Hamiltonian-like constraint, and the other one which is a diffeomorphism-like constraint. These constraints satisfy this constraint algebra, which is an SL2 R algebra, and the model also is equipped with six observables, which are a kind of phase space areas that are preserved under the gauge group. Instead of this observable, we will consider this combination of them, which is a more convenient choice for our purpose. They satisfy this commutation relation, the Q's and the P's commute, which is other. But on the solution space, these observables are not all independent. They satisfy three conditions, non-linear conditions. This with respect to the Casimir of the group that vanishes on solutions, and this other condition, which is this product of the observables, is a linear combination of the constraint together with some phase space function. Okay, in the solution space, it has a topology that are four cones joined in the origin. Two of the cones are given when the p's are equal to zero, and the other two are other two cones where the q's are equal to zero. And the origin is given by this condition, where both of the observables, the q's and the p's, are equal to zero. Okay, this is the classical system. Now I will introduce the classical discrete theory. For it, what I will do is I just have to select a function in the phase space, this H, which I will call in the following the discrete Hamiltonian, and this Hamiltonian has to satisfy some condition in order to achieve a good defined discrete model. This Hamiltonian has to be a functional of the constraints. First of all, it has to be positive, definite, non-linear on the constraints. It has to vanish in the origin, that is where the argument are all equal to zero, the Hamiltonian has to be equal to zero, and it has to satisfy this condition with respect to the derivative of the argument of the function, that has to be different from zero, the second derivative, anywhere in the phase space. In particular, we have a huge freedom in selecting this function, but we will select this particular quadratic form in the constraint, which looks like the most simplest one. And also it resembles the master constraint, as you can see. Okay, once I have selected my discrete Hamiltonian, what I do is check which are the constant of the motion in the discrete theory. You can check that the Q's and the P's, the discrete Hamiltonian, and this constraint commutes with the discrete Hamiltonian, and therefore the evolution for them is trivial. However, there are other quantities, like the other two constraints of the theory, that do no longer are conserved quantities. They evolve, but the evolution of them in the discrete theory is under control, in the sense that I can recover the continuous solution when I take the limit in which the discrete Hamiltonian goes to zero. And therefore, these two constraints vanishes in that limit, and therefore if they vanishes at some discrete time, they will do in any other time. Okay, therefore what I have seen is that with this discrete theory, I'm able to recover the continuum classical theory I am interested in. Therefore, what I'm going to do is, okay, I will check what happened when I quantize this theory and see whether I am able to get a continuum quantum theory, or if not, if I'm at least able to get a continuum classical theory from this discrete quantum one. I will adopt a standard quantization for the standard one, in which the configuration variables as a multiplicator operator, the momentum as a derivative ones. I will set the reduced Planck constant equal to 1 for a moment. And I will represent the constraint, as you can see, as differential operators. Regarding the diffeomorphism constraint, it is it has to be selected in a factor ordering that is anomaly free. It provides an anomaly free constraint algebra. This has been done for convenience in order that we are going to compare this quantization approach with the standard algebraic quantization, and there one has to select properly this constraint. Okay, the next step is, okay, I know what are the constraints. I construct my discrete Hamiltonian at the quantum level, and therefore I look for the solution of this Hamiltonian. I will diagonalize it. The quantities I can diagonalize simultaneously are the discrete Hamiltonian, one of the constraints, and two of the observables. The spectrum of the constraint is, and the two observables is given by some integer numbers. And regarding the spectrum or the spectral resolution of the Hamiltonian, the discrete Hamiltonian has a continuous part, which is determined by a real number as the eigenvalue of the constraint. And the discrete part is given by another parameter, which takes some discrete values, and also the eigenvalue of the constraint mentioned before. What we can see is that the spectral resolution of the discrete constraint that do not include the zero eigenvalue. Therefore, we can already say that with this description, I will never recover the continuum quantum theory, which will correspond to a vanishing eigenvalue. Okay. However, our proposal in order to study several aspects of this formalism is considering as possible candidates to physical states the whole infrared spectrum of the Hamiltonian of the discrete Hamiltonian constraint. And there, and appealing to the observable algebra, we can also check that in the discrete part of the spectrum of the constraint discrete Hamiltonian, we find some states, those which satisfy this condition, that requires or that impose additional condition to the observables that is given by this relation. And this relation is, in summary, this one. This condition is more or less compatible with the classical solution space, in which you have some restriction in the Qs, where the Ps can take any value, and or either you have some restriction in the Ps when the Qs can take any value, or almost any value. Moreover, this solution space belongs to the original kinematical. Therefore, we don't have to change from our kinematical description to another physical Hilbert space by appealing to some kind of rigging map or reality condition to the observables, or etc., etc., etc. However, there is a problem that this space subject to this condition here is not invariant under the whole observable algebra. For example, if you restrict the study to the Q3 equal to T, when you add with this Q plus on that state, you go to the state T plus 1. Therefore, this condition is broken. However, we believe that we can find which are the observables. We codify all the relevant information in that subspaces, and therefore also they respect them. And for it, what we do is define, or what we can do is define, the observables that preserve all the relevant information on those spaces. And for it, we change slightly the operators, original operators, multiplying to the right and the left by this operator, such that when we add on the solution space, this Q plus adds by annihilation, in the sample I put before, and so on and so forth for the rest of the spaces and the observables. Okay, let me just comment on previous proposal and different quantization approach. For example, what it was done in the master constraint approach, that basically is exactly the same that our discrete Hamiltonian constraint, is restricting the study to the minimum non-vanishing eigenvalue. The non-vanishing because we don't have zero in our spectrum, therefore we take the minimum one. There it belongs to the continuous spectrum. There you cannot find any restriction to the possible values of the observable Q3 and P3. Therefore you will see that this solution space by itself is not compatible with the continuum theory. However, one can introduce such a condition, like a kind of cutoff in the quantum theory, by including the corresponding constraint in the master constraint, apart from a particular shift regarding the minimum eigenvalue. There, one can find that this solution space is compatible with the classical continuum theory. However, one finds also that the relevant information is codified in this family of observables, where this sine function plays the same role or similar role that the epsilon function I have defined here. Finally, in the algebraic quantization approach, what one do is, okay, find which are the solutions that solve all the constraints. You can find them. They are labeled by an integer number, m, and a parameter epsilon that takes values 1 or minus 1. These solutions do not belong to the original kinematical Hilbert space. Therefore, one has to introduce physical inner product in the model. For doing it, what one requires is the reality conditions to the family of observables, together with some additional observable which are reflection in those solution space. And this reality condition allow us to find a suitable inner product. This inner product, however, is not compatible with the states in which m is equal to 0. Therefore, one has to be sure that those states are not present in the solution space. And once have decoupled those states, one can construct the physical Hilbert space. The remark I want to do is that the physical Hilbert space coming from this description and the kinematical one are completely different, in the sense that the inner product in both cases is a different one. Okay, I want to summarize the main result is that we have been able to achieve quantization description within the uniform discretization approach, that it requires to consider the whole infrared spectrum of the discrete Hamiltonian that will allow us in the future study the dynamics of the model, in the sense that we have several energy levels, and therefore the system can evolve among them. And also we have find a suitable observable algebra that is compatible with the solution space. In addition, the Hilbert space The physical Hilbert space is a subspace of the kinematical one, therefore we have not to include additional structures in our model. And finally, what we will do in the future is study the quantum dynamics of the model. In particular, we would like to compare two different points of view about the quantum evolution. One is the so-called evolving constant that basically consists in describing the quantum dynamics of the model by identifying some phase space variables as time parameters, which obviously requires to consider them as a classical quantities instead of quantum ones, because the construction requires that. And we would like to compare it with the conditional probabilities, which basically respect the quantum nature of all the phase space variables, in the sense that these conditional probabilities provide an evolution in terms of a probability distribution, which is telling you which is the value or which is the probability of your function to have a given value when you measure another phase space function at some moment. And that's all. Thank you.
So do we have super selection sectors in the end or not?
If I have super selection sectors?
Yeah.
In particular, for each value of this parameter t, you have a different super selection sector. And in addition, for each particular value of t, you in fact have four sectors. Like if you divide the two-dimensional plane in the Q's and the P's, that plane can be divided in four sectors, depending on the orientation of each variable. And in each four sector, you have one solution, two lines joined by a point that can be identified in like the origin of the two lines, like two lines joining like this, and two other in the other plane, in the semi-plane, two other and two other.
Okay, so that's in general. And the last speaker is Rodolfo. Rodolfo turned into Said, right? But I believe they speak about similar things.
Yeah. So, as Bianca told, and you may have noticed, I'm not Rodolfo, sorry for you. The best you get is me. So for that, because I'm going to talk in the time that was for Rodolfo, I'm going to talk about the work previously we have done with Rodolfo and Jorge. The classical part, actually, partly with Rodolfo and Jorge, and about three classical results and one quantum semi-result that is almost finishing, but there are some small technical issues. So, it's about the CGHS model. And what's the CGHS model? It's basically in 91, I think, as if I remember correctly, these four people introduced this two-dimensional dilatonic model. The CGHS is the first letter of their names. This is a dilatonic model which comes from the string theory, and as you see, it's almost this dilaton field is almost like it's a scalar field, but it also has a direct coupling to the scalar curvature. And then, we have also the matter field here, and this is the dilaton field and the cosmological constant, everything. Why we work with this? The reason is that it contains like black hole solutions, Hawking radiation, FRW cosmology, everything. But at the same time, it's simple enough to, which is that's the reason that people are interested in it, and it's a good test bench for quantum gravity analysis. Like, and the reason is that it's classically solvable. It's easier to handle in many situations, easier than four-dimensional models and everything. So that's the reason we chose it. And what I'm going to address here is that this is actually the summary at the end, but it comes at first. So we can write the theory in Ashtekar-like variables, very similar to the way we can write 3 plus 1 in Ashtekar-like in Ashtekar variables. By similar, I mean you from a generic two-dimensional dilatonic model, you make canonical transformations, and the canonical transformation is very, very similar in both cases. I will show you later. So but many of the things that you can do in 3 plus 1, you can do it in this CGHS model, maybe easier, a little bit at least. The other thing is that in this formulation, we will see that we have the possibility of the traditional Dirac quantization, because the constrained algebra, we can turn it into a Lie algebra, even in the presence of matter. And because of that, we have two other possibilities, like sub-possibilities. One of these is that maybe we can resolve the singularity as what Gambini and Poulin did a few months ago for the 3 plus 1 model in the Schwarzschild 3 plus 1. It's a work under development. It's near its ending, but well. The other thing is that because we have this Lie algebra, even in the presence of matter, maybe we have a chance for implementing the back reaction or easier or something like that. The other thing is that in addition to the Dirac quantization, we can also turn the theory, the Hamiltonian, into a true local Hamiltonian, which is not only true, but it's local. And then we have there the possibility of reduced phase space quantization. OK, so let's see how we can write this in Ashtekar variables. I try to avoid as much formula as possible. Sorry. So this is the almost generic diffeomorphism invariant action. I will tell you what does almost mean. But let's say generic diffeomorphism invariant action, two-dimensional, which gives us second-order differential equations for the metric G and a scalar Dilaton field phi in two dimensions. And this is the matter part. F is the matter field, and the phi is the Dilaton field. This is the potential of the Dilaton field, and you have these Y, V, and W, which are model-specific functions of the Dilaton field. You can change them and get 3 plus 1, or CGHS, or several other models. For example, this model contains CGHS, in which phi there is a Dilaton field. Or you can get 3 plus 1 spherically symmetric model, there phi is not the Dilaton, really, in the real sense, but is this factor that appears in front of the two sphere in the metric. So basically, what we do is a standard procedure. Do the 3 plus 1 1 plus 1 decomposition. In this case, write the theory in tetrads in first order, and then make a Lejeune transformation to a generic Hamiltonian. Until here, we have a generic Hamiltonian. So you can write a generic Hamiltonian and then change it to whatever you want. Now we choose these three special functions of the Dilaton field just for the CGHS. So now we are working in CGHS. Now, this is the crucial point, which we make it from here, which was generic. And this is kind of obvious. But this part is you make a canonical transformation to get you from that generic Hamiltonian to the CGHS model. And you see here, these are our new variables, EX, EFI, and EX, that in 3 plus 1, you have them. And eta is just a gauge angle. Then later, it will be omitted in the Hamiltonian. And these are the old variables, P1, P2, P, and P omega. And the omega is, for example, the canonical conjugate to P omega, etc. Then you get, in this case, you get a second class Hamiltonian, which is written in Ashtekar variables, namely these EX and EFI and their canonical conjugates, and the Dilaton field and its momentum, and matter field and its momentum. But it's a second class constraint. You have two, in addition to the Hamiltonian diffeomorphism and Gauss constraint, you get two other constraints, which are, that's why it's a second class constraint. They don't. The Poisson bracket doesn't vanish weakly. And just as a side note, look at the transformation that can, this was a transformation that could give us, that could get us from the 3 plus, the generic Hamiltonian to the CGHS. Now, look here, this transformation, which is very similar to this one, takes us from the same generic Hamiltonian to 3 plus 1 spherically symmetric. The difference here is just this factor. And there is the two factor there. That these things appear because of the form of the metric in 3 plus 1 and form of the metric in the CGHS. So for example, here, the form of a metric in 3 plus 1 is E phi squared. So then you have P1 squared minus P2 squared equal 1. then so at the end you get E phi squared. So this is related to the form of the metric. Well, equal to E phi squared, actually. So again, what we do is kind of a standard procedure. We solve the second class constraint. We put constraints, we put them equal, strongly equal to zero. So then in this case, we omit phi and p phi, which are dilaton field and its conjugate. Then we put it back into Hamiltonian. Then now we have eliminate the Poisson brackets and go to the Dirac brackets. But the thing is that the Dirac brackets are not like this. The form of the Dirac brackets is not, let's say, standard in the sense that, for example, you get two canonical variables. In a standard form, it should vanish, but you have a non-vanishing term here and here. Now, we observe that there's a very simple transformation that you can make from kx that we have previously to a new variable, which is called ux. We don't use kx anymore, we use ux. And if you write ux instead of kx, it's very simple to see here. Your Dirac brackets will take the standard form, and the calculation would be simpler even for quantization and everything. It would be like that you have Poisson brackets. Okay, so at the end, well, this should be something else, but at the end, we get a total Hamiltonian density in new variables, which is, as expected, a sum of laps multiplied by a Hamiltonian constraint plus shift, which is just one-dimensional, one shift, multiplied by diffeomorphism constraint. So this is the form, at the end, what we get. We are working with this Hamiltonian, total Hamiltonian. OK, now let's see how we can turn the constraint algebra into a Lie algebra, thus getting the possibility of Dirac quantization. So this is kind of looks very simple. You just have to find a way to rescale the laps and shift in this way. So you get from the old laps to the new laps, and old shift and old laps to the new shift. And then at the end, you can write your Hamiltonian density like this. This is the new laps, new shift, the Hamiltonian density, diffeomorphism, Hamiltonian constraint, diffeomorphism constraint. And this part, you see, you have only here the gravitational degrees of freedom. And this is the matter part. And the gravitational part is the total derivative. And note that there is no ux. Ux is the conjugate to ex. There is no ux here. So simply, it's very easy to see that this commutes with itself strongly. It has an abelian algebra itself. But it turns out that not only that total derivative, without the presence of matter, you have a strong abelian algebra with Hamiltonian constraint itself, but also in the presence of matter. I think this doesn't happen in 3 plus 1, the matter case. So we maybe have a chance of easier maybe implementing the back reaction in CGHS rather than 3 plus 1. The other thing is that then, because of this thing, this algebra here, we have symbolically, we have this. We have a Lie algebra now between the constraint, because the problematic part was this Hamiltonian constraint itself. Now it's a strongly zero. So there you have the Lie algebra. And then this method, the same method, works for the 3 plus 1, but vacuum 3 plus 1. This is a quantum kind of just mentioning something that. Because as I showed you, CGHS is very similar to the 3 plus 1 model in this formulation. So there is a possibility that we can use the same method that Gambini and Pulin used for the elimination of singularity in the 3 plus 1 case. Namely, as a summary, it was that the metric, they found a new observable. The metric can be observable, I mean the evolving constant of motion. Then you can write the metric in terms of that, and then metric is an operator. And the self-adjointness of the metric operator, the demandness for the self-adjointness, gives you, basically turns the singularity into a region with a very high curvature, but not singular. So as far as we have gone into this issue, there are some small technicalities. But it seems that you can do the same. You can remove the singularity of CGHS too, in the same manner. And the last part is the possibility of reduced phase space quantization, namely finding a true local Hamiltonian. People have tried to find true Hamiltonians, but in many of the cases, they are not local, in the sense that the lapse, for example, is an integral of canonical variables. We show here that we can find a true Hamiltonian, which is also local. So we use the deparametrization and gauge fixing. That is, it has a history by the theory by Brown and Gukash, then Thiemann and Gesell, and then the Gambini and Pullin did it for the 3+1 case, and Alvarez, of course, it should be Alvarez here. And so there, I explained it in steps as an example. It's a general procedure, but okay. Here we first, we should, you know, normally when you have two constraints here, when you gauge fixed normally, you get nothing. Because you fix everything and then there's nothing to, you need new Dirac brackets to go on and do something, or well, everything would be zero. So we do it this way. We fix the first gauge, and we put ex, which was one of our variables, equal to a function of just a space. And then the preservation of this constraint gives us this condition, which is the shift is equal to zero. Basically, you are getting rid of the diffeomorphism constraint. And then the partially gauge fixed total Hamiltonian is just lapse multiplied by this Hamiltonian constraint. If you remember, this was the total derivative, and this is the matter part. And the second step is now, this is the part that the parameterization, and well, it is by using a canonical transformation. You equate all of this inside the total derivative equal to a new canonical variable. Then you have a canonical transformation. Then you have the conjugate to this x. It turns out it to be equal to this h, which we saw here, this h, the gauge fixing parameter, and the function of k phi and x, and this something like that. The next step is now find k phi from the weakly vanishing of the Hamiltonian constraint and put it back in here. So basically, this becomes only a function of f pf. This is the same. Well, this part is this part. FPF, matter field, and x. Now, this would be this thing multiplied by lapse would be your new total Hamiltonian. It describes the same dynamics, describes the same the constraint surface as the previous one. And so there you got it. This is the total Hamiltonian. Now it's very easy to deparameterize it because, look, now if you fix the second gauge, if you put x equal to a function of time and space, then there you see this part and this part, none of them depend on x because x is fixed and this is completely deparametrized and everything. And apart from that, this gauge fixing, the consistency condition gives you n, the lapse, as a very simple variable, not as an integral of canonical variables, which would be non-local. So in this sense, this gauge fixing makes it local. And after putting everything, after putting these two gauge fixing into this total Hamiltonian, now this part, which you see here, is your, well, multiplied by this, but after gauge fixing, is your true Hamiltonian. This gives you the true dynamics of the theory. And there you can go and this is the reduced phase space method. So just to see how does this gives you the dynamics, like for example, you want to find f dot or pf dot, it doesn't matter. So you want to find the Dirac bracket of this f, and remember that it was like Poisson bracket in our theory. F and this total Hamiltonian. But this total Hamiltonian, you look f here, f or pf commute with px. So you only, only get the contribution from this part, well, after gauge fixing is this. So the contribution only comes from the true Hamiltonian, and this gives us the true dynamics. And once again, I'm going to just note that this is important. This is local density in the sense that n is not an integral of canonical variables, and thus the Hamiltonian is not an integral of an integral, which means that in that sense, we mean it's non-local. And this part is also important because equations of motion would be local. If not, then the quantization would be messy. I mean, I don't know if it's possible. Yeah, so, and the last thing is just a summary. Well, what we showed that the CGHS can be written in similar Ashtekar variables and as in 3+1, from both of them from a generic two-dimensional Lagrangian. And because of that, they're very similar. First of all, the constraint algebra can be cast into a Lie algebra. So you have two possibilities, possibility of completing the direct quantization and maybe implementing back reaction, just a possibility. The second is that also you have the because of this possibility of direct quantization and similarity to the 3 plus 1, you can maybe use the same method that Gambini and Pulling used for the 3 plus 1 black hole and eliminated the singularity. Maybe you can eliminate it here too, which is very optimistic as far as we have seen in our calculations. And the last point is that, well, you also have the other possibility of using the reduced phase space quantization, because you also can find the true local Hamiltonian for this model. Thank you.
What do you do with this local Hamiltonian?
Well, currently I'm working on the direct part, direct quantization. But then you can do the, you know, the paper by Thiemann and Christina. So that's one possibility that you can do with the same method. Yeah.
So let's thank Said again.